From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. We get a lesson in screenwriting from Robert Town, who wrote the screenplays for Chinatown, Shampoo, and The Last Detail. He wrote and directed the new film, Tequila Sunrise. Also today, I speak with detective novelist Joseph Hansen. The central character in Hansen's novels is a rarity in the world of detective fiction. He's a death claims investigator who happens to be gay. And we have reviews of comedy albums by Sam Kinison, Dennis Miller, and Will Durst, and of the new film Mississippi Burning. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the 1970s, Robert Town became known as one of the best screenwriters in Hollywood. He was brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and The Godfather, and he wrote the screenplays for The Last Detail, Shampoo, and Chinatown. In 1975, Pauline Kael described Town as a flaky classicist with an ear for unaffected dialogue and a gift for never forcing a point. In 1982, Town directed his own screenplay for the film Personal Best. Now Town is back with the second film he both wrote and directed, the thriller Tequila Sunrise. It stars Mel Gibson and Kurt Russell as two former best friends who now seem to be on opposite sides of the law. Gibson plays a drug dealer who says he's gotten out of the business. Russell is a cop who's been assigned the job of busting his old friend. Michelle Pfeiffer plays the woman they're both in love with. After Pfeiffer has an affair with Russell, she accuses him of having used her and others to get information about Gibson's drug dealing.
You lie to me about Mac, you lie to Mac about me, you lie to the judge about everybody. Sooner or later you have to lose sight of the facts, don't you?
No. No, you don't lose sight of the facts, not unless you're nuts. You lose sight of your feelings. Mac knows how he feels. He's crazy about you and he doesn't want to get caught. For a crook, it's crystal clear. On the other hand, for a cop, it's confusing. Mac's my friend, and I like him. McGuire's my associate, and I hate him. I probably have to bust my friend if I'm going to do my job. And I hate that, but I hate drug dealers, and somebody's got to get rid of Carlos. How do I do that?
Tequila Sunrise is in part about conflicting loyalties that make it sometimes necessary to maybe betray a friend or a colleague. Why were you interested in writing something about that theme? Does that relate to you personally at all?
Well, I think it relates to all of us who work in a business where your efforts to make a movie are so time-consuming that you can't tell your personal from your professional life apart, can't tell them apart. And any time that happens, you don't know whether you're dealing with a friend or a colleague or both, and it gets confusing. So I think it's something that is certainly germane to us in the making of movies in particular, and to, I think, everyone in general. I mean, since I can remember, there has been, I think, an increasing conflict among all of us about the wisdom of doing our job as against personal loyalties and personal friendships.
This is your first film since 1982 when you wrote and directed Personal Best. I know that that film ended in a lawsuit, and then you ended up going through a divorce and a custody battle. And I was wondering if those events were responsible for the hiatus between films.
Yes. What can I say? I think that it certainly put a dent in my ability to work professionally.
By that, do you mean that you personally weren't up for making a movie, or that it was hard for you to get others to give you the chance to make one?
Well, I mean, I'll never know that, really, because the first time that I was able to complete writing something that I wanted to direct which was Tequila Sunrise, I was given the opportunity to direct it. I do think that that when your real life, when your day-to-day life, when your becomes more interesting and fascinating than your fantasy life, it interferes with your ability to write fantasy because you're living it. And when melodramatic events occur in your life, when it just becomes time-consuming, then your ability to obsess about a fantasy is more limited. So I think that it necessarily interferes with your ability to work. I don't know whether or not, had I finished something in that time frame, that I would have been given the opportunity to direct it. All I know is that when I did finish something, I was given the opportunity.
Well, this is the second film that you both wrote and directed, and I'm wondering if you take liberties in writing when you know that you're going to be directing it yourself, and you know, therefore, that the director will know what the writer meant in a certain scene.
No, I don't. I mean, I write a script no differently for myself than I do for anyone, for someone else. I think that in some ways it's more difficult directing your own script because you do make that assumption. You as the director, I as the director, make the assumption that I must know what this script is about since I wrote it. But the press of events on a set, all the technological problems and all the Rube Goldberg machinery of a movie is such that you are just as affected by it as any other director, and you may have less of a tendency to do what a director who has not written the script does do, which is to say, what is this scene really about it at the most basic level? And I think a writer-director has to constantly remind himself to ask the same question he would had he not written the script. I mean, what is this scene about?
I know as a writer you have to protect yourself if you can against wrong interpretations that that a director might take with a movie. I know that's happened to you, that you've had, I know you had a whole movie that you thought was totally misinterpreted, Greystoke. You had meant to direct it yourself, but it was taken away from you in a deal. And anyways, you hated the result so much you ended up putting your dog's name as using your dog's name as your credit for screenwriter. Is there an example in a movie where a scene that you wrote was very misinterpreted and you were upset at the way it was interpreted by the director?
Well, let me just kind of go on record with Greystoke. I've never seen it, so I don't know what it is and isn't in relationship to the script that I wrote. I've only been told by people who have seen it that it doesn't bear a lot of relationship to my script, and therefore I took my name off it simply because I wouldn't want my name on something, even if it was good, if I wasn't really responsible for it. So that's just a matter of kind of bookkeeping, really.
Mm-hmm.
As far as an example of a scene going wrong, I don't know that occurs to me as readily as scenes that go right. I mean, it's been the thing that you learn when you're working is that the best thing that can happen to you as a writer is to see a scene that you've written imagined properly. I know that in the case of Tequila, though, that the actors who were first reading the script would tend to read into the situation a great deal more surface intensity than I intended. And when I would ask them to, kind of lay off and be casual with the dialogue, they realized that it was in fact funny and not melodramatic. And that probably would never have happened had I not been able to be there to kind of kick the attitude more toward the attitude of Shampoo than at least in the surface textures than some kind of highly melodramatic situation, and let the melodrama just build in terms of the structure rather than the surface tone.
Can you think of an example of a particular line or sequence where the meaning was totally changed by the line reading, by the way it was delivered?
Well, let me see. I think in terms of tequila, we're talking about an early scene with Kurt and Mel when they're talking, and Kurt sits down and confronts Mel in the restaurant about an activity that had happened earlier in the evening when Mel had been nearly busted on a supposed drug deal. And Kurt says, the federal government swears you're doing business in here. And Mel says, why? And Kurt says, well, what do you mean, why? You're a drug dealer and you don't pay your taxes. Now, just the levity with which he, the casual nature with which he said that, I think actually changed the scene. Other people who had read it were trying to be extremely intense with it, and it was dead wrong. These are guys whose attitude is to try to minimize the potential hazards of any confrontation. Because in my experience, guys who are in potentially life-threatening situations try to minimize the implications of that as much as possible by being as casual as anybody having dinner and talking about pasta. I think that's a general example of where tone really affects the text.
Robert Town is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise. As a screenwriter and director, you have to work with silences in movies, and I think you've used silence very effectively, both as a screenwriter and director. In Chinatown, for instance, there are scenes where Nicholson is trailing, for instance, Faye Dunaway, and I mean, there isn't any dialogue in that, but it's very gripping, and you had to imagine that in your mind. In Personal Best, there are sequences where there really isn't a lot of dialogue at all. It's very visual. It's interactive between the two characters. Does silence have a different meaning when you're writing and when you're directing? And is it frustrating as a writer to write silences in?
No, it's not. I think that so much of screenwriting is what I guess you would call, if you were an architect, negative space. In screenwriting, what you don't say is at least as important as what you do say. I don't find it frustrating at all. I find it demanding. It's a discipline to try to imagine exactly how much you don't want said. And one of the benefits, of course, of directing is that you can control that. It is a difficult thing to control. You can put it on the page, but you can't really control how it's going to be implemented, which, of course, is a reason for directing yourself.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. Screenwriter and director Robert Town is my guest. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Robert Town wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise, which stars Kurt Russell, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Mel Gibson. Town also wrote and directed the film Personal Best and wrote the screenplays for Chinatown, The Last Detail, and Shampoo. You wrote the screenplay for Chinatown. Roman Polanski directed it. Polanski played a small role in the film. He played the part of a henchman who's hired to intimidate Nicholson to get off the case. And what Polanski does is take out a pocket knife, stick it into Nicholson's nose, and basically slit his nostril open. Whose idea was it to cast Polanski in the role? Was it yours or his?
I think that was Roman's idea.
The line that you gave him to say was, "Know what happens to nosy fellows, they lose their noses." Why did you want to cut the nose? It seems like such an interesting, really offbeat way of hurting somebody.
Well, I was looking for a way to do something that I felt would appeal to your imagination in terms of just a tiny little violent act that was scary. I really didn't want to go into the kinds of violence that had been rife throughout films at that time. I wanted to have a minimal amount of violence, but I wanted to suggest that it was nevertheless a very violent world out there. So I thought of something that I would really hate to have happen to me, and it was that. And it seemed appropriate for a detective anyway. A detective who is like a hound, is sniffing out the trail of some kind of criminal or villain. It just seemed like the perfect thing to do.
What was very subversive about it was that it meant that Jack Nicholson, the leading man, had a bandage on his nose for half the movie. And even when he took the bandage off, he had a big cut and stitches on his nose.
Well, once again, in most movies, you can see people fight in a way that would have crushed skulls, created probably, quadriplegics with both combatants, and they emerge unscathed from the battle and continue to go out throughout the film with a bruise here or there, which disappears in the next scene. Well, in fact, that doesn't happen. I mean, if somebody gets hurt, it hurts. Just a tiny little slit in your nose can really smart, and it can affect the way you look and feel for weeks, and in this case, for the rest of the movie. It was just an attempt to just like Chinatown was an attempt to deal with a real crime that involved something as seemingly prosaic as land and water, that little act of violence was an attempt to suggest that you can really hurt people by doing almost nothing at all, just a tiny little slit of their nose.
I want to ask you a little bit about writing a climactic scene, a scene in which there's really a turning point in the story or in their character development. In Chinatown, the real turning point scene, or at least one of them, is when Faye Dunaway reveals that the woman whose identity she's been hiding is really her daughter as a result of an incestuous relationship. Her father had, the Faye Dunaway father had raped her when she was 15. And I want to just play a clip from this scene and then ask you a little bit about the considerations in writing this kind of climax.
I don't know what you are talking about. This is the craziest, the most insane thing.
Stop it! I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. He hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl is a witness. So you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you got the money to keep her mouth shut. Yes or no?
No!
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister and my daughter.
It's a really such a dramatic way of bringing across that revelation, and to have, especially with the slaps in between, that's, I don't know if people can make that out in the clip that we heard. But can I ask you about planning that, writing that climax, and if you had written in the slaps, if you thought that that would add to the drama of the moment?
Well, yes, they were written in. I think that any revelation of any kind is only credible, particularly one that is shameful, at least whether or not there's any moral stigma attached to it. It certainly is embarrassing for the Faye Dunaway character to have to admit to it. And the only way you're going to believe that what she says is true is if she's reluctant to talk about it, and that's putting it mildly. I think that, as a general rule, anything that you want an audience to believe is something that a character has to reveal reluctantly. Any kind of free and easy revelation is one that I think we automatically suspect is not true. We just, glibness is whether or not it is in fact true. It's certainly dramatically true that glibness is generally tantamount to insincerity.
Chinatown has one of the most often repeated lines of recent film history, and that is just about the last line of the film, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." And that's said by one of Nicholson's assistants after everything's gone wrong, after Faye Dunaway's been killed and the evil father is free. How did you come up with that line? Did you realize it would have as much resonance as it did and that people would be repeating it for years after?
No, but the line the line was intended to be what it is, and I guess it just worked. Chinatown itself, I guess, is a sort of metaphor for the futility of good intentions. You simply individual actions don't necessarily matter, even though we'd like them to, even though we'd all like to be like Rambo and think we could single-handedly win a war that we lost, and Chinatown suggests that a good man or a man who is not necessarily good all the time but would like to do something decent has his hands full when he tries to disentangle the Gordian knot that is really the kind of thing that most of us have to disentangle if we're going to do anything decent, which is kind of applicable in a way to Tequila Sunrise, which where the cop again has to confront the fact that he's in a real thicket in terms of who's good and who's bad and how much good he's going to do by as a result of his actions by busting his friend. And I think that his dilemma is not dissimilar to the Nicholson characters in Chinatown. He has to make a choice. Does he do his job or does he honor loyalties? And most of us, ever since we've seen popular entertainments like James Bond, where he's licensed to kill, have always felt that, we've kind of worshipped the job. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. We got to get those, you know, we've got to destroy the city in order to save it. We've got to win at all costs. And I think that you have to reach a point where you say, do I have to win at all costs? Is it... am I going to be saving more than I'm destroying? And that the answer to that is a little bit different in Tequila than it was in Chinatown, but the question is the same question, and that is the connecting link, I think, between the two of them.
In a way, in Hollywood, one of the ways you got your start was as a script doctor. You were brought in to solve problems on movies that I guess... had serious problems with them. You were brought in as a script doctor for Bonnie and Clyde and for The Godfather. Could you give me an example of the type of problem you were brought in to solve on one of those two screenplays?
On The Godfather, there had never been a scene in the novel that existed between Marlon and Al Pacino. Where the father whose favorite son was the one that was to take over as the head of this criminal family. There had never been a scene where he was able to sit down and say, you're going to take over and this is what it's going to be. And they needed it. And suddenly they came to the point where they were going to lose Marlon in 24 hours, and they didn't have that scene. And they basically... as it was originally suggested to me, wanted a scene where the father let the son know he loved him. And it was my job to go in and write that scene, which I did by suggesting that the father's concern for his son and his son's future and his need to take over, because he was the only one who was fit to take over this criminal business, was so great that... he was obsessively worried about all the day-to-day details of bodyguards and phones and tapped phones. And through expressing that concern, he let his son know that he was bitterly sorry that he had to pass on the dubious honor of being the head of the family. And the son let the father know that... he accepted because it was inevitable, and I wrote the scene.
Were there directors who let you on the set, let you sit in before you started directing yourself? And I ask this knowing that a lot of times screenwriters aren't really welcomed on the screen because the director wants to be able to make choices himself or herself without the screenwriter standing over their shoulder and making their own suggestions.
I have always been, maybe it's because I started so much of my work by doing rewrites that I didn't have the kind of threatening cachet of the originator of a piece of material, which I think is always a threat to a director, since it reminds him that he's in the role of basically an interpretive artist. And since I wasn't in that position, I was less of a threat in the early stages of my career, and it did allow me to be on sets. I was expected to be on sets because I was rewriting very often on a daily basis and had to be there with the pages for everyone to go over what I'd done to see if it was going to work. So I automatically spent a great deal of time on sets. Almost every director I ever worked with not only allowed me on the set, but insisted on it.
Is that how you learned how to direct, by watching?
I don't know how anybody learns to direct. I suppose the best training I had was how I learned to write, by being in acting classes and watching really fine actors improvise. I think that it not only helped me in terms of screenwriting, but it probably was the single best training I had to work with actors in movies.
One last question about Tequila Sunrise. I feel like I maybe shouldn't give away the ending. I'm sure you'd prefer that I don't. But you had a choice to make there about whether this was going to be a happy ending or an unhappy ending. And I'd be interested in what goes through your mind when you're making that kind of decision.
I think that without giving away the ending, I think we can still talk about it. I think that an unhappy ending would have made, in the case of Tequila Sunrise, you have if one of the two men dies, that movie becomes about that man and that man alone. He becomes a tragic figure. If the men survive, then it becomes about the nature of their relationship and the nature of relationships in general. I think it's more complex if somebody survives, and I think that the choice that you make is one where the characters and what they stand for remain on more of an equivalent level. The cop and the criminal are of virtually equal importance thematically if they survive. If either one of them dies, whether it's the cop or whether it's the criminal, then the character who dies becomes the most important character in the movie. So you must understand then that the writer obviously felt given that choice, it tells you what the writer thinks about those characters. If they survive, then he thinks they're both equally important.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us about movies. Thank you for your time. My guest has been Robert Towne, and he wrote and directed the new film Tequila Sunrise, which stars Michelle Pfeiffer, Kurt Russell, and Mel Gibson. His earlier credits include the screenplays for the films Chinatown, The Last Detail, and Shampoo, and he also wrote and directed the film Personal Best. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Alex Shumatov, and he's a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. He's written about the rainforests of the Amazon, the pygmies of Zaire, and the creation of Brasilia. He chronicles scenes of contemporary African life in his new book, African Madness. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Joseph Hansen started writing novels in the late 60s, he wanted to make the point that all homosexuals aren't hairdressers or interior decorators. Coming up, Hansen discusses his series of detective novels about Dave Brandstetter, a homosexual death claims investigator. Stand-up comics have been called the rock stars of the 80s. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by three of comedy's biggest stars. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Mississippi Burning. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Reaction was generally favorable today to the Reagan administration's decision to open talks with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Favorable except in Israel. Members of Congress for the most part applauded the move, and the decision was greeted by banner headlines in the Arab world. We have two reports on the reaction to the Reagan administration's decision, the first from NPR's John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Israeli officials said today they faced a different situation when they got up this morning because of Washington's decision to talk directly to the PLO. Nevertheless, Israeli leaders stressed two points in their reactions: that U.S.-Israel relations remain as close as ever, but also that Israel is in no way bound by U.S. actions concerning the PLO. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir accused the United States of being duped by the PLO's show of moderation. But Israeli Cabinet Minister Ezer Weitzman of the Labor Alignment said sooner or later Israel will have to end its isolation and join some internationally sanctioned negotiating process.
Someone said today that it's a sad day for Israel. I disagree. I don't say it's a happy day, but it's a beginning of a process that at the end of it, most likely, I sincerely hope so, will bring very happy days.
For now, Israel must tolerate a changing international situation while struggling to form a new government, a process that is expected to be slowed, not accelerated, by the week's events. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
This is Ted Clark in Washington. Members of Congress generally supported the U.S. decision to open talks with the PLO, though many of them remain skeptical that the group will live up to the promises Arafat made. Nevertheless, the consensus on the Hill seems to be, let's put the PLO to the test. Democratic Congressman Mel Levine of California, who authored the legislation setting the conditions for a U.S.-PLO dialogue, said today he would not second-guess Secretary Schultz's decision to open talks.
As the author of the language, I think that Secretary Schultz had a very difficult decision to make. The language was out there, and I give the Secretary a great deal of credit for never altering the test, never lowering the threshold, never reducing the standard.
The incoming Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell of Maine, said talking to the PLO is a first step, but a significant step toward advancing the peace process. And Republican Senator Richard Lugar, a former chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, said Arafat has proved he's at least willing to pay the price to get a seat at the bargaining table. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Reagan moved to assure Israel today that the U.S. has not moved one inch away from its commitment to the Jewish state. While in Tunisia, the U.S. ambassador made the first officially sanctioned contact with the PLO in 13 years. Officials say substantive talks between the U.S. and the PLO could get underway as soon as tomorrow. In other news, President-elect Bush met today with a prominent black educator reported to be under consideration for a cabinet-level job. Dr. Louis Sullivan, president of the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, is one of two blacks that Bush is said to be planning to name to his cabinet. The other is Julius Becton, a retired three-star general mentioned for the first Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Sullivan reportedly is under consideration for Secretary of Health and Human Services. The Justice Department today said four Cuban refugees imprisoned for committing crimes in the U.S. are being deported back to Cuba. Officials said the men will be flown to Havana tomorrow aboard a U.S. Marshal Service aircraft. They were among thousands released from Cuban jails by Fidel Castro and sent to the U.S. during the 1980 Mariel boat lift. It's the second such action this month. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa said today formal roundtable talks with the Polish government are close at hand. At a news conference in Gdansk, Wałęsa said Poland's communist leaders are moving closer to accepting his outlawed trade movement's main condition for attending the talks: publication of an official declaration of intent to consider re-legalizing Solidarity. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Comedian Sam Kinison's new album is in the top 20 on the pop charts. A&M Records has created a new comedy label called Blue Rose. And rock critic Ken Tucker says stand-up comedy is entering a new age of cool. Ken says nowadays there's a fine line between a stand-up act and a rock act.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Miller!
Thank you very much. Nice to be here tonight.
It used to be that comedy records were a genre unto themselves. Whether it was Bill Cosby or Bob Newhart, the Firesign Theater or Nichols and May, these were albums you'd play over and over, memorizing the punchlines, luxuriating in the witty cadences of the comedians. Comedy, even when it was savage and profane in the case of Lenny Bruce, had a certain structure, a discernible purpose, a recognizable rhythm. These days, however, comedy albums are chaotic, aggressive, often aimless affairs that try to partake of the noise and abrasiveness usually associated with rock and roll. The best-selling comedy record right now is Sam Kinison's Have You Seen Me Lately. Kinison really wants to associate rock and comedy. On his new album, he even yells his way through a version of the classic oldie Wild Thing, modifying the lyrics to suit his hostile style.
Wild Thing, I think you moved me!
It just came to my mind. I thought I'd say that.
You made me trust you, then stuck the knife in my heart. You're a lying, unfaithful, untrustable tramp, but I think I love you.
You might know Sam Kinison from TV, shouting and screaming on David Letterman, or on those cable comedy shows that allow the jokers to use four-letter words. On Have You Seen Me Lately, Sam Kinison tries to speak your most vile thoughts and turn them into comedy. He's very cruel. This album has stirred numerous protests from gay rights groups about his comments on AIDS, and it's hard to find something to play on the radio because of the constant barrage of obscenity. But Kinison does have one great subject, religion. He was himself a child evangelist, and he knows both the Bible and the people who use it for a wide range of purposes. You'll get some idea of Kinison's style as he chats here about his own interpretation of the birth of Christ.
He didn't even know he was the son of God. His parents, as soon as he was born, as soon as he was able to speak the language, his mom said, "You're the son of God." When you were born, the angel came, and the star stood in one place, the wise men brought gifts, and the whole world's been waiting for you to come and do great things. He's like, "Really? Me? I eat you?" Everybody but Joseph. Joseph's walking around going, "Yeah, you better be the son of God, I'll tell you that. You had better be him, little mister. And you better be the only son of God. You understand what I'm saying, honey?"
Sam Kinison's comedy avoids politics, probably because his sort of full frontal assault on society can't cope with the subtleties that political analysis would yield. There hasn't been a good, overtly political comedian in this country since before Mort Saul turned neoconservative, but there's one in the early stage of development just now, Will Durst. Durst attacks Democrats and Republicans with equal scorn, and to his credit, he's already been banned from Late Night with David Letterman for being, quote, too political. Durst performs on a new anthology album of four comedians called Strange Bedfellows. Here, he offers a few observations about George Bush's role in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Reagan's point man on Iran-Contra. Reagan's point man on the war on drugs. And he doesn't know when he knew that Noriega was dealing. The point is moot. Either he knew, and he's a doofus, or he didn't know, and he's a doofus. Either way, we don't need another Oval Office doofus. Now, let me get this straight. We sold arms to Iran, and then gave military intelligence to both Iran and Iraq. Now, how did this work? Here, put this gun in your pocket. He's got a gun in his pocket. He knows about the gunman.
Another comedian with a new album out is Dennis Miller, whom you may know as the caustic anchorman on Saturday Night Live. Miller's mouth is twisted in a permanent sneer, and with his flowing locks and impeccable suits, he denies the image of comedians as neurotic nerds. Miller carries himself with the cool haughtiness of a rock or movie star. Lots of people I know don't care for Miller, finding him smug and condescending, but I think that's why he's interesting. On his new record, which he calls the Off-White album, he's not afraid to make himself look somewhat elitist if it will permit him to turn a cutting phrase elegantly. He's rude and entertaining at the same time, as when he talks about regional differences like this.
I was in Birmingham, Alabama, working a small comedy club called I Don't Get It. And Alabama. You talk about Darwin's waiting room. You know, I mean. There are guys in Alabama who are their own fathers. You know, I mean, this is the... it's the sort of place where people read the Sunday comics with a yellow highlighter. Just in case they stumble across a particularly meaningful passage in Beetle Bailey that... Yeah, I think the only more backward place I've ever been is West Virginia. You know, I mean... this place makes Mayberry look like a think tank. You know,
There's a certain disposability to comedy records these days. You probably wouldn't play Sam Kinison's ranting over and over the way you once did your Firesign Theater albums. But the best of these records suggest a healthy range of style and subject matter that makes them worth checking out at least once.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Some kind of wild thing that went through our lives and made it hell. Cause everybody's had one, you, me, nobody likes to lose. And you know she's out there laughing at you. I don't care if it was last week or third grade. Someone broke your heart. What was her name?
This is Fresh Air. Crime fiction is a genre where macho never seems to go out of style. Dave Brandstetter, the protagonist of Joseph Hansen's mystery novels, is tough and smart in the private eye tradition, yet he's different in one way. He's homosexual. Obedience is Hansen's 10th Brandstetter mystery. Like his previous books, Obedience is set in Los Angeles, Hansen's home for the past 50 years. As the book opens, Brandstetter, who is in his 60s, has decided to make a change.
He was quitting. But notifying all the insurance companies in the West he'd done death claims investigations for in recent years turned out to be a long job. He had sat down to do it after lunch and was still typing away in a lonely little island of lamplight in the looming raftered room when Cecil Harris walked in at midnight. A field reporter for television news, the tall, lanky young black, lived with Dave. He ambled down the room, glanced over Dave's shoulder as he passed the desk, hung his jacket on the hat tree and rattled glasses and bottles at the bar.
Why was Dave Brandstetter thinking of retiring?
Well, it has something to do with him, and it has something to do with me. It had to do with my arrangement with my publisher. I wasn't very happy with the contract I had, and... But the contract sewed me up in such a way that it looked as if I couldn't write any more crime books without writing them for him, so I decided that I wasn't going to write any more crime books.
Did that change? Did the situation change?
The situation changed.
So you brought him back out of retirement.
So I brought him back out of retirement.
I love it when there's reasons that have very little to do with the character for, for changing
well,
a character's life.
Well, of course, I do have other things I want to write, and... but now I have a new contract with a new publisher, and it's a very good one, and so there will be two more Dave Brandstetter books.
So he's back in business.
He's back in business.
Now, Dave Brandstetter, the hero of your novels, is gay. And I was wondering why you created a gay character to work within the detective genre.
Well, it's a subject that, I'm homosexual, and so I figured that I wanted to write about that. I had hoped by writing about homosexuals in a mystery novel to draw readers to read painlessly and with some fun, some recreation, about a subject they know very little about, in my judgment. And so that's why I decided on the mysteries. Of course, I like the mystery form very much anyway, and always have. But this was a deliberate plan. And also I wanted to, I thought, there are a lot of small jokes hidden in the first novel, Fade Out, and among them is the idea that of giving to a homosexual the toughest job that fiction, genre fiction, provides, that of a private eye.
Was putting him to work for an insurance agency an in-joke also?
That was an in-joke also, yes. Insurance companies, in my experience, do not like homosexuals either as employees or as risks.
Now, some detective writers really don't like to give their characters much of a private life. Ross McDonald, I think, is a good example of that. How much of Dave Brandstetter's life, private life, do you like to put into your novels?
As much as they will bear. I think a character is far more real, who has everyday problems to solve, who has a love life and a home life and things going on for him. I always felt that lack in the Lou Archer books. And I wanted it also to be ongoing, and it has been. He's people come and go in his life, and he's grown older.
In your novel, Early Graves, your next to the last novel that just came out in paperback,
yes.
The plot has to do with AIDS. There's a serial killer who's killing homosexual men who have AIDS. Did you realize that you had to work AIDS into one of your stories?
Oh, yes. I've always dealt with very prominently in my books, although I've taken up other subjects as well, other serious social matters. Homosexuality has always been foremost in my mind, and it's often it often occurs in various characters and situations in the novels, and people were asking me, well, when are you going to deal with this one? And of course, I said, well, I must do that. I must do that, but I put it off because this subject horrified me, as it horrifies us all. Ultimately, I came to grips with it and did it, but it was just doing the necessary reading and getting the facts, as dismal as they are, straight, was an unpleasant experience, and writing the book was not easy.
Was there information that you wanted to get into the book as well as a good story?
Oh, of course. But mainly I wanted people to know how it feels, and that's why there is a chapter in it in which a young man tries to write out the story of his life and how he feels about having AIDS and coming to death so young.
Your first Dave Brandstetter novel was written in 1967. You probably knew at that time that having a gay main character would probably be pretty controversial in publishing circles. How did you first describe him? How did you first introduce the fact that he was homosexual in the novel?
His lover has just died, and I simply say that. Perhaps not that simply, but that's what has happened. And I didn't make any bones about it. I just wrote about him as he was, and it took a while to find a place for that book, but ultimately Joan Kahn, the very prominent, very famous, and deservedly so, mystery editor, was then with Harper and Row, saw the book and liked it very much, made no comment at all about the leading character being homosexual, and I thought she had a lot of guts and a lot of courage and to publish the book, and the rest is history.
Before the book got published, did you get rejections that you...
Oh, yes.
Did...
Oh, yes, all over the place.
What kind of comments did the rejections come
from? they didn't admit why they were rejecting it. That's
people in those times especially, or more so than today, people were reluctant to say, well, come out and say flatly, this is about a subject that readers don't wish to read. I've had rejections from magazines of stories on that basis and made quite candidly our readers are not ready for homosexuality yet. But no, the book publishers are a little shyer than that. They wouldn't say why.
Didn't you have an early novel that ended up getting published by a publisher who wanted to turn it basically into a pornographic novel?
Oh, yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was published, and the publisher asked me to add graphic sex scenes to it, and I did. The book has been, what was it, about 9 years later, the same editor at the same house came back to me and said, gee, we would really like to republish that book and publish it this time the way you wrote it. So it was published again, and now it is in the shops one more time. The title is Pretty Boy Dead, and that was my first attempt at a mystery novel.
Were you glad to take out those explicit sex scenes, or were you sorry to see them go?
No, I was glad to take them out. People just wear out certain portions of a book and don't read the rest of it if you put that kind of scene in.
In your novels, you're clearly trying to, in addition to telling good stories, to challenge stereotypes about gays, about ethnic groups. When you started reading detective fiction yourself, were there stereotypes you found in the novels that bothered you?
Oh, terribly, yes. Yes, all over the place. They didn't bother me as much then because we were more used to them. They were they were just there, and one kind of dumbly accepted them. If you were going to read popular fiction, you got used to reading stereotypes, but I certainly never intended to use such stereotypes in my own work, and I hope I never have.
Joseph Hansen's latest Dave Brandstetter mystery, Obedience, is published by Mysterious Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you tracking reaction to the U.S. dialogue with the PLO?
Sure. We'll be hearing from John Hockenberry in Jerusalem for some both Palestinian and official Israeli reaction to the Schultz announcement yesterday. Also talking with James Zogby, an Arab-American activist, and also with Ehud Olmert, an Israeli parliamentarian. Very, very different views, as you might imagine.
Anything new from Armenia?
Yes, Ann Cooper is back in Moscow from a trip down to Spitak, which is a village that was just devastated by the earthquake, and we'll be hearing that account. And from this country, we'll be hearing about the Cleveland default 10 years later, a report by Jackie Lydon.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the summer of 1964, young civil rights workers moved into Mississippi for a voter registration drive. Three of them were murdered, two whites and a black. Director Alan Parker has made a new film about the subsequent investigation. Parker's other films include Midnight Express, Fame, and Shoot the Moon. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Mississippi Burning.
When the documentary Eyes on the Prize began appearing in theaters and on public TV a couple of years ago, one couldn't watch without being struck by the drama of the civil rights movement. And not just the drama of the beatings and killings and marches, but the stirring fortitude of black sharecroppers, housemaids, laborers, many of them illiterate, rising up en masse to resist injustice. Where did they find the heart for it, one wondered, and the courage? Who were these extraordinary, heroic people? If a movie could answer those questions, and not in the usual platitudinous TV movie terms, it might be terrific. But Mississippi Burning is not that movie. If anything, it's a step backward. Alan Parker's film is based on the 1964 murders of three young civil rights workers in Neshoba County, Mississippi, and the massive FBI investigation that followed it. Gene Hackman plays the local FBI man assigned to the case. He knows that the life of a small southern town takes place in its barbershops and social clubs. And it's in the local barbershop that he gets a whiff of what he's up against from the town's officials.
We got a real peaceful little community down here, Anderson. Of course, they're just like any other folks, I reckon. Push them too far. Well, I figure it's like three sticks of old dynamite. You shake it up, and we're going to be scraping bodies off the street.
I'm just down here to investigate the missing three kids, ask some questions.
Oh, if it's all boiled down to gravy, it wouldn't be enough to cover up a chicken fried steak. Them kids you're looking for, I'd just about bet you a shiny new dime. They're setting up in Chicago right now, drinking a cold beer and having a big laugh about all the commotion they've stirred up down here.
Well, I sure hope so.
That scene is a mite overwritten, but it shows Mississippi burning at its best, capturing the textures of the Deep South. It also shows Gene Hackman at his most solid and convincing. But still, if he's supposed to be wrestling with his own racial attitudes, as sometimes he seems to be, the movie has utterly failed to bring his turmoil front and center. Instead, Alan Parker turns his film into a routine police procedural, with racial injustice scooped on like so much icing. Willem Dafoe is stiff and unconvincing as the by-the-book Fed sent by Washington to crack the case. And the battle between his prissy methods and Hackman's good old boy brutality becomes the heart of the movie. The tension builds until we're just aching to watch Hackman give some of these bigoted goons what for. Our reward, when he finally starts wailing on them, is the catharsis of violence that American audiences seem to want now from everything, whether it's a civil rights movie or a Geraldo Rivera show. In short, Mississippi Burning takes the low road. It panders to the thug in us, and then tries to make us feel virtuous by making fervent speeches about how it's not just the Ku Klux Klansmen who are to blame for racism, we're all guilty. This movie boils the noblest social movement in recent American memory down to a battle between the good white people and the bad white people. Blacks are represented almost exclusively as cringing victims, a view that's not only a grave distortion, but also, in its own way, subtly and perniciously racist. When it's time to hand out the Oscars, I'm sure Alan Parker will be remembered. But for what? For convincing his audience that the war for civil rights was won by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI?
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Richard Russo grew up in a small town in upstate New York. Now he describes himself as a wandering American, someone who can only return home as a visitor, but will never be a true resident of any other place. On the next Fresh Air, Russo talks about his new novel, The Risk Pool. Also, pianist and singer Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, returns in our weekly performance segment. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Rain Man, starring Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.